Welcome to Soundings, a weekly program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
And part of the difficulty, again, is that the sentimental appeal to an often white audience was an appeal that asked that audience to recognize somebody who they would otherwise see as quite different from themselves. And in the theatrical production of Uncle Tom's Cabin, little Eva is shown above Uncle Tom's head, welcoming him to heaven.
Right.
So there's a very perverse notion of miscegenation bound up with the idea that all hearts beat alike, and that becomes the sentimental appeal.
Well, if we were able to transport ourselves back in time for an hour to have tea with a great aunt or a great grandmother, someone we had never known, I'm sure, in fact, that we would find something we recognized. We'd look into their face and see something in their eyes or her sound of her voice, or maybe even the fact that she wanted three lumps of sugar in her tea, like I did. And we see ourselves, we would see ourselves mirrored in this woman.
Sentiment, Sentimentality, and a Daybook of Writing by American Women, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for conversations with Lois Stiles Edgerly and with Shirley Samuels. Lois Edgerly will discuss her Daybook of Writing by American Women, a volume entitled Give Her This Day. After that, I'll talk with Shirley Samuels about her study of sentiment and sentimentality in 19th century American literature. Shirley Samuels teaches at Cornell University. According to Lois Edgerly, American history has too long been silent about the lives of women. Lois Edgerly's collection, Give Her This Day, a Daybook of Women's Words, gathers writing from women's journals and letters from libraries and historical societies nationwide. Give Her This Day is available from Tilbury House Publishers. Lois Edgerly, welcome to the National Humanities Center. You've got a wonderful book here, Give Her This Day. Who are these women?
Well, they're unknown and lesser known. A lot of them were forgotten women from the 19th century. Some of them are famous. We have, you know, Harriet Beecher Stowe. I forget the famous ones quicker than I do the.
Well, you had to work your way through a lot of people here, lot of documentation.
I did, but they range from all kinds of professions. I have a little maid who scratched out a little diary every day on how many loaves of bread she made and how many rooms she had to sweep, to a college president, Mary Lyons.
Where did you cook up this list? I mean, was this a wish list that you came up with, Lois? You've got 366 women quoting from something that they wrote, a letter, a diary, a journal. How did you put all of that together?
Well, when I finally decided I was going to have a day book, then I needed to have a day for a woman for each day on the day that she was born. So sometimes it was not planned. I just would search for a woman who was born on, say, February 8th, and just hope that I would find someone who had written something that was worth including.
And where did that search take you? I mean, did you live a lot of your time in the library?
Oh, yes.
Did you network? How did all of that come about?
Well, I traveled all over the country and went to historical societies and libraries. And often when I was in a historical society, I would just start out standing at the card file and looking and see what, finding women's names, and then seeing if one of them had a birthday I needed. And it was like a treasure hunt.
Who's the most interesting character that you came across? Do you have a favorite, Lois Edgerly, having looked back at 366, an arbitrary list, but one that compels you nonetheless?
Well, I have many favorites. It's really hard to choose, like choosing between children. You can't do that. But I like Lucy Larcom, mainly because I think I give her credit for getting me started on doing the book.
Who was she? When did she live? What did she do?
She was a a poet, an old Victorian poet, and she was also a Lowell mill girl, had worked in the Lowell textile mills in Massachusetts. And she had a very menial job. She worked there as a 10-year-old. And she would look out the window and make up poetry, and then when she left her job, she would write it down. And later she became a teacher, and I think she had a great little bit of a, well, maybe it wasn't great, it was little, love affair with John Greenleaf Whittier.
The poet.
The poet. And the intriguing thing is that there's a small mountain range in New Hampshire called the Ossipee Mountain Range, and there are three mountains, and there's Whittier, and then Big Larcom, and Little Larcom. One day I was in a canoe in a pond that's below it, and I asked my guide, what are the names of those mountains? And she said, Whittier, Big Larcom, and Little Larcom. And I said, who was Larcom? Who was he? And she said, oh no, she said it was a woman poet. And I thought, isn't that curious? I don't know any mountains that have been named for women. So I looked into her.
Uh-huh. And this was a woman who was both a poet and a mill worker.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Then she wrote a book, a day book. The day book was a literary form that was used a lot in the 19th century. And people would, there were lots of times that were just a day book. Someone would like their excerpts. And this is what Lucy Larcom did. She gathered things from other writers that she loved, and she had one for each day. There were day books like Longfellow. There was a day book of Longfellow's excerpts, and Shelley had one, and Webster. And I thought, isn't this delightful? And that's where the idea came from. I'll have a day book, and I'll put unknown women like Lucy Larcom, and I'll have one for each day. So in a way, Lucy's beckonings, that was the name of her day book, beckoned me to do this. In fact, at first I was going to call the book. I was going to entitle it Beckonings.
Lois, give me a sense of specifics here, an example from your book.
Well, Ida Lewis is a wonderful example. She's one of my favorites. She was special in a way because I didn't think I was going to be able to include her because I couldn't find anything she had written.
You knew about her, but you couldn't find anything.
Yes, she had taken over. Her father was the lighthouse keeper at Lime Rock Lighthouse in Newport Harbor, and he had a stroke, and she was 16, and I think he wanted to keep the income, so she started to do the job for him. And she did the job for 50 years. Of course, he died in the meantime. And she saved many people from the waters of Newport Harbor, and some of her rescues became nationally known.
Oh, what a wonderful metaphor. You have the individual professional experience, and then you have the emblem, as it were,
speaking to us. And, I couldn't find anything that she had written. Down in the Newport Historical Society, they have her little boat that she did her rescuing in, and her medals that the different societies awarded her.
So she wasn't responsible simply for the lighthouse, but for actually getting out there and helping people if, to her knowledge, they were in trouble.
She used to jump into her skiff and rush out and row out and save them from the waters.
My goodness.
And somebody at the Historical Society said, no, you'll have to give up because we don't think Ida knew how to write, that she couldn't write, and so therefore you won't find anything.
And yet here you have an example of, a letter?
And this was a letter that I did give up. And then a couple of years later in Philadelphia, at the Pennsylvania Historical Society, I was doing research on another woman. Mm-hmm. And just by chance, there was a list in the Gantz collection of letters, and it said, Henry King Smith, letter from Ida Lewis.
And here it is.
And there it was. And I was so thrilled. It was such fun. Well, anyway, this is what she wrote. To Henry King Smith, it was written May 4th, 1889. To Henry King Smith, dear sir, yours of April 14 was duly received. Please pardon my long delay in answering. You wish for me to state how many lives I've saved altogether since I have had charge of the light at Lime Rock. I will say in reply, 16. Respectfully yours, Ida Lewis.
Here's somebody who takes herself very seriously.
But the thing is, it was enough so that I could include her in the book. And they had a wonderful picture, and that wonderful picture was, I think, enhances her story.
Now, in contrast to Ida Lewis, who is very sober and gives a very straightforward answer, do you have people in this, do you have any women in this book who sound, in contrast, a lighthearted note?
Well, I think Abby Bright. She was a teacher in a one-room schoolhouse in Kansas, and she had a wonderful, we can tell she has a wonderful attitude and laughs at herself. She wrote, January 20th, this is from her diary. We often see a mouse run around the room. Last Monday, there were two frozen on the stove hearth. This a.m., I was sitting by Ruth, helping her with the arithmetic lesson, when I felt something move between my dress and skirt. I was wise enough not to make a fuss, for I guessed what it was. I got up quickly, went out the door, shook my skirts vigorously, and down dropped a mouse.
My goodness.
Another thing I can be thankful for, that I am not afraid of mice.
She certainly didn't sound that way.
No. But we can smile and wish we could have been as cool-headed as she was.
Here we've just looked at a couple of women who are not household names, who appear in your book, Give Her This Day. What about women who are? What about Harriet Beecher Stowe, for instance?
Well, she was wonderful. Of course, we all think of her because of Uncle Tom's Cabin, and I thought for a while I would just find something nice from Uncle Tom's Cabin to include as her writing. But then I found this nice piece that had come from something she had written in 1873 about starting a home for stray dogs.
A home for stray dogs.
Well, and I like that. She wrote, "How much dogs suffer mentally is a thing they have no words to say. But there is no sorrow deeper than in the eyes of a homeless, friendless, masterless dog. We rejoice, therefore, to learn that one portion of the $20,000 which the ladies of Boston have raised for our dumb animals is about to be used in keeping a home for stray dogs."
Is it fanciful, Lois, to look back at these women and say that they are examples for women in the United States in the 1990s, or is this is it back there by itself on its own terms? Does it speak to us today?
Oh, I think it does. I guess maybe I'm fanciful, but I think that we can take their courage and strength and examine it and wish it on ourselves.
Lois Stiles Edgerly is the editor of a collection of writing by American women. Lois Edgerly's book is entitled Give Her This Day, A Daybook of Women's Words, available from Tilbury House Publishers. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on writing by and about American women continues. You'll hear next from Shirley Samuels of Cornell University. Shirley Samuels is the editor of a volume entitled The Culture of Sentiment, Race, Gender, and Sentimentality in 19th Century America, scheduled for publication later this year by Oxford University Press. Here is Shirley Samuels.
Well, the usual way that people understand the idea of sentiment hasn't changed much since the 18th century. That is, sentiment refers to ideas about feelings, mm-hmm. how you respond emotionally to given stimuli. Sentimentality, as in the 19th century, is a kind of pejorative way of talking about how people respond to their feelings.
Yeah.
That is, a sort of trivializing of feelings.
Yeah, don't be sentimental.
Don't,
really looking
so
down your...
That's so sentimental. Uh-huh. How could you say such a sentimental thing? That means that what you've done with your feelings is trivialize them,
yeah.
is turn them into something that's Hallmark cards, or turn them into something that's Harlequin romance territory, as opposed to the real sentiment or the real
yeah,
feelings.
Yeah, but no, we're not always noble people with noble high intentions. Mm-hmm. It's okay, as they say, to cry, to express mm-hmm. yourself. draw the line for me between sentiment and sentimentality in literary terms.
Okay, in literary terms, it's been used to denigrate certain styles of literary production, notably in 19th century America, to make fun of people like Lydia Sigourney, the sweet singer of Hartford, to make fun of the idea that what you're doing is in the kind of mourning rituals that people had, where there was actually a stock way that death would be celebrated by a willow tree over a tombstone with a girl with long hair leaning on it pensively and perhaps cut out pieces of the dead person's hair braided around the frame of this picture.
You're talking about Mark Twain and what's the little poetess's name?
Emmeline Grangerford.
Emmeline Grangerford, right, that he has so much fun with.
Yes. And there's a kind of counter tradition to how this sentimentality worked in the 19th century, which is what I'm very interested in, that is to carry out certain reform tactics, especially with things like the temperance movement, which was extremely active in the 19th century, where there would be little children's books, terrible tearjerkers, full of stories about how mother, full of gin, rolled into the fireplace and burned up, and what will happen to little Tommy now. Now, what goes along with that idea, that form of sentimentality, is often an interesting political or reform program. That is, that there are pretty good reasons for wanting people not to drink themselves and to death in the 19th century.
Okay, now you're unpacking a lot of baggage here in front of us. We're talking about sex and gender and feeling and sentiment and literary expression. Let's take them maybe one thread at a time. When we look at the 19th century in America, we look back and we think we have the great writers, quote unquote. And after a fashion, what you're suggesting here is coming afresh to this notion of what constitutes our literary nationality or nationalism, and in paying attention to the things that traditionally we have dismissed, notably sentimentality. Now, talk to me for a couple of minutes about that, set against this notion of the great writers, our inherited culture.
Absolutely. All right. One way in which people think about this when they're talking about the 19th century literary canon is to try to set somebody like Nathaniel Hawthorne against what he notably called that damn mob of scribbling women.
Right.
Now, what he's responding to is things like the Twain caricature of Emmeline Grangerford. But what he's also not acknowledging, and what's kind of interesting about how people read Hawthorne in the 19th century, is his own sentimentality. That is, a number of Hawthorne's early short stories and sketches were tearjerkers or were celebrations of small scenes of village life. I mean, he announced in the preface to The Scarlet Letter that he wanted to be remembered for a rill from the town pump.
That's right.
Which is quite absurd little piece.
Now, what about the irony underlying a statement like that? I mean, he's talking about sentimentality and making fun of himself?
What I'm arguing is that once you start taking a category like sentimentality seriously, you don't need in quite the same way to separate out the serious writer. And in this collection of essays that I've been editing, The Culture of Sentiment, Race, Gender, and Sentimentality in 19th Century America, one of the things that I'm really interested in are different historical, literary, art historical approaches to how the rhetoric of sentiment can be adapted for different purposes.
Let's pause on an example. You bring up Nathaniel Hawthorne. He has a character named Phoebe in The House of the Seven Gables, who is, at first glance, is this very mushy, sort of little wimpy, sentimental type of character. Is that the way we should play it all the way through the novel? What do we read there?
Okay, well, what I'm reading in part is the divorce of a term like mushy from a term like sentimentality.
Okay.
That is, I'm trying to look at sentimentality as itself a kind of force, which is an appeal to the emotions, an appeal to the emotions which is easy for us to trivialize now because we don't particularly like to notice how our emotions get appealed to. So some of the same tactics, for example, that somebody like George Bush would use in talking about why we need to go rescue poor little Kuwait.
Right.
Some of these tactics of sentimentality are still applied in very highly charged political scenes. And that what I'm really interested in looking at 19th century American authors is how those kinds of tactics get established. That is, what sorts of appeals to the emotions are used, even by writers who would disavow what has come to sound like a charge of sentimentality.
All right. Now, one of the issues that is, speaking of charged, one of the issues that runs like lightning through 19th century American writing is the issue of race. how do these writers bring to that enterprise the use or the abuse, the ends and the means of sentiment and sentimentality?
Yeah. One of the writers that I'm very interested in is Lydia Maria Child, who is actually a contemporary of Hawthorne's, who, like him, grew up around Boston and had early success with a novel called Hobomok, which was actually about Indian white miscegenation. Mm-hmm. That is, it was about
The Jewel and the Crown, 100 years before The Jewel and the Crown.
Yeah, although she sets it in the time of the Puritans. Uh-huh. So it's very curious.
Couple of 100 years.
But when she gets involved with race, after having been an extraordinary success, and early, I mean, in her 20s, she was the second woman ever admitted to the Boston Athenaeum. Hmm. She had a monthly magazine for children, which was very popular. She'd also written guidebooks for the home, as well as writing these novels. She partly persuaded by William Lloyd Garrison, got persuaded to the anti-slavery cause, wrote a nonfiction tract called An Appeal on Behalf of That Class of Americans Called Africans, mm-hmm. which was in many ways a straightforward attempt to tell a political and economic story as opposed to a sentimental story, and was banned. That is, she was kicked out of the Boston Athenaeum. All of the parents of these children who realized that she was involved with the question of race trashed her magazine. Her publishers dropped her, and she spent 10 years working her way through anti-slavery writings back into the public eye.
Well, now, why would the reaction have run in that direction? If, I mean, after all, Boston was a bastion of abolitionist thought.
Boston,
was it the employment of the rhetorical devices that upset people? What was going on there?
At that time, Boston was not a bastion of abolitionist thought. It was more of something called the colonization movement, which favored sending the freed slaves back to Africa. There was a lot of resistance to the idea of immediate emancipation. The idea was fraught with the language, a sort of Gothic horror of what had happened in the island of San Domingo, where slaves had killed their masters. She was seen as somebody who was subverting the very language of the home and family that she'd been promoting in her earlier writing.
Uh-huh.
And it was also dangerous for a woman to be in that way in the public eye. There were.
What should we make then, in light of what you're telling mm-hmm. me about Lydia Maria Child, what should we make of a story, for example, I think of Herman Melville in this mm-hmm. wonderful story, Benito Sereno, mm-hmm. about a slave uprising. Now, is that a straightforward sort of documentary history? I mean, he's drawing on what we call history. Mm-hmm. Does he have these abolitionist ends in his sights as he writes that story?
Well, this is a very good point. This is another way in which the processes of sentimentality have been put outside of the literary canon, because they're seen to have a purpose. That is, they're seen as polemical, uh-huh. and their very polemics are seen as non-literary, whereas Melville's Benito Sereno, which in many ways is taking on the question of abolition, is seen as literary because it can be read as not polemical.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a very strong connection between the early women's rights movement, or as it was called then, the woman question, and the abolition or the anti-slavery movement. There are lots of ways in which women who first started speaking about slavery then began speaking about women's rights. And there's a kind of debate about whether or not women learned about their own rights through thinking about the rights of slaves.
Same thing happened in the 1960s.
There's a very strong correlation between uh-huh. what happened, especially after the Civil War, when women who had been extremely active in the anti-slavery cause wanted the franchise, wanted the right to vote, couldn't understand, as long as we were changing, as long as we're going for amendments, why not give women the right to vote as well as freed male slaves?
Sure.
They were called betrayers of the cause. There was a very similar kind of reaction to what happened in the 1960s about whose rights came first. How are you going to measure them? What kind of quantification is involved?
Mm-hmm.
There are clearly a number of both racist and sexist assumptions on both sides. That is, that there were women who found that the cause of the white woman mattered more to them than the cause of the slave. There were people who were against slavery who completely ignored the cause of the black woman. I mean, there are a lot of very difficult gradations of political endorsement involved there.
What you're telling me is that gender, if not sexuality, is a social construct, that that we take our cues, we send our cues from what surrounds us rather than what we are necessarily by nature biologically. Was that the case in the 19th century? Again, are we imposing a kind of contemporary concern on those primary documents back there?
you could suggest that they were if they weren't so self-conscious about it, and if they hadn't recorded their self-consciousness in diaries, in letters, and in their publications. So that there are some, I mean, if the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848 hadn't called attention to the idea that the rights of women was part of the Declaration of Independence, although it hadn't quite been mentioned then, if there hadn't been such an insistence on it as an outrageous political platform, I think there'd be some cause for saying, oh, what we're doing is imposing current feminist values on the period. But I think that with the kind of evidence that's present in the period, it's rather difficult to say that.
Mm-hmm. Here's a footnote to our conversation, Shirley Samuels. From your standpoint as a teacher of American literature and a writer of reviews and articles, literary history, are you optimistic about what we call American literature? You know, there are a lot of people who are saying, well, it's gone to hell in a handbag. We live with minimalism, that literary historians are this arcane lot off by themselves. They really have nothing to do with the larger social enterprise. How do you think about that?
I'm actually very optimistic. Part of my optimism has to do with the sense that American literature is such a live literature, and its liveness is noted by the way in which it can incorporate so many different kinds of attitudes and approaches, not only in the 19th century, but now, the way in which American literature now incorporates Asian American literature, African American literature, Chicano, Chicana, Latino, Latina, the literature of immigrants, the literature of people who have never been represented before, that there's a kind of relationship between new students coming into the universities and asking to read about themselves and discovering literature which both represents them and challenges them.
It's like a rubber band that contains many, many threads, flexible threads.
And I'm not at all bothered. I mean, I recognize that it's a question that perturbs a number of people. But I'm, perhaps because of my generation, less perturbed by the idea that we should look for an essential greatness and look for a few classic works. I'm much more interested in looking at different styles of literary production and trying to figure out what they represent by themselves. I'm more interested in that than in trying to sort out the absolutely best works that have to be read from works which might, in one way or another, contaminate that idea of greatness.
Shirley Samuels teaches at Cornell University. Shirley Samuels is the editor of a volume entitled The Culture of Sentiment, Race, Gender, and Sentimentality in 19th Century America, scheduled for publication later this year by Oxford University Press. You're listening to Soundings, a weekly program of conversations and commentary from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings on Writing by and About American Women is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 564. That's program number 564. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code 27709. Send $2 for a complete summary of Soundings discussions available on cassettes. And when you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station.
You've been listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Next week, discussions about working class culture in France and the Soviet Union. Wayne Pond will talk with scholars from the University of Paris, Duke University, the University of North Carolina, and the Institute of International Labor Movements in Moscow. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Sentiment and Sentimentality, and a Daybook of Women's Writing, this week on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for conversations with Shirley Samuels and with Lois Edgerly. Shirley Samuels will talk about her new book, The Culture of Sentiment, Race, Gender, and Sentimentality in 19th Century America. Lois Edgerly will discuss her Daybook of Writing by American Women. Sentiment and Sentimentality, some answers and insights from the National Humanities Center, this week on Soundings.